Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much to the slightly absent Lutfi Siddiq for inviting me along this morning. Great pleasure to be here. I think we've got a fascinating panel coming up. Just to introduce the panelists, on my right, your far left, you have Jeffrey Wu of UBS Asset Management. Sitting next to me, Ying Staten of the Global Council, Peter Mumford of Eurasia Group, and Cesar Purisima of the Milken Institute. We're going to have a look at risk, all kinds of risk affecting Southeast Asia, geopolitical, economic, monetary, and I hope we'll be teasing out all aspects of risk and opportunity. As always in these events, I'm hoping to learn a lot. I think we've got an awful lot that we can talk about this morning. Last week was a whirlwind for emerging markets. I'm on the emerging markets desk at the Financial Times. Normally spend a lot of my time editing something called EM Squared, which is a data-driven analysis service on FT.com, but found myself, as ever, sort of drawn into working on what was going on in Argentina and Turkey and elsewhere last week. And of course, one of the things that we were looking at and everybody else was looking at is who's next? Where are the other vulnerable countries? Southeast Asia has fared pretty well, but there are vulnerabilities that we can see. Current account deficits, trade deficits, large exposure to foreign investment, either foreign portfolio investment or reliant on foreign debt. And we saw Indonesia unexpectedly raising rates last week as a defensive measure after, I think, 2-3 years of monetary loosening. We've been seeing a lot of commentary about Malaysia possibly being in the firing line for that as well. So I hope we'll be teasing some of that out. We'll be looking at trade issues. We've had notes this morning coming out talking about a trade truce between the US and China. Let's see how long that lasts in the roller coaster ride that's been Trump and China. We'll be looking at how China influences the region, whether perhaps a comment I heard from somebody the other day that we're starting to see the formation of a small renminbi currency area in Asia with the rise of the regional supply chains and the importance of that for manufacturers and others in the region. The rise of India, what does it mean? We've got a story coming out this morning in the FT, and India's aviation minister saying that India will become the second biggest aviation market in the world after the US, looking far forward in 2038, where he expects to be having 1 billion flights a year. And we have the moon of the US, the dollar possibly receding in the region, the moon of China rising. What about the moon of India? Is that kicking in as well? Plenty to talk about. Let's have a few minutes opening remarks from each of our panelists, and then we'll get on some questions. Jeffrey, perhaps I'd like to go first.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Slightly out of my element, I must say, given normally we are focused on advising private clients in an EM context, and I'll be the first to admit ASEAN doesn't really come up into our conversations that often. But I think this, if we look at what actually led to the situation in terms of the lack of investor interest, this can bring me to the first risk that I would highlight when it comes to thinking about EM right now, which is liquidity risk. Now, there are two types of liquidity risk when we want to think about the concept from an investor point of view. The first is what we're witnessing across markets right now. EM currencies are in freefall. I'd be the first to admit that from the house view of UBS Wealth Management, this isn't exactly how we expected the year to pan out. If anything, emerging markets, ASEAN included, was one of our top calls. We remain quite optimistic on the Indian rupee, for example, and Brazilian real, another currency that we like. But the market is not differentiating right now. There's one common strain. They look at, for example, in their assessment, so the market's assessment of what happened after the elections in Malaysia, and they're looking at the elections in Brazil and Mexico, just saying right now, populist environment, central banks, they are basically held hostage by governments or prospective governments who want to give free handouts. this is going to blow up the fiscal situation, high oil prices could blow up the inflation situation, and crucially, EM central banks do not have the balls to raise interest rates, raise real rates aggressively to basically push back against, not exactly an EM currency crisis, but the acceleration in outflows. That is the market narrative, and again, I'll be frank, it's pretty hard to push back against it right now. Markets think, you know, EM is a bit like catching a falling knife, but at times like this, when we think that global growth is solid, you know, when the Chinese engine in particular is stabilizing and there's upside risk, now's the time for value really to come through. So if you think of emerging markets in general, I'd say put yourself in the shoes of a stock picker, right? And there will be, you know, gems ready to actually pick up. Not exactly at a discount, given where valuations are, but value is emerging. So that side of market perceived liquidity risk in terms of contagion crises, I'm not too worried about right now, right? So probably this afternoon, Argentine rates are going to go to 50%. So then you can throw that trade back in my face, right? I had an investor 3 weeks ago ask, hey, it's 25% right now, it looks attractive. And then last week it went to 40%. So, you know, what can you say, right? The second type of liquidity risk, I would say it's a liquidity opportunity as well. So I go back to my earlier point. Why does ASEAN, you know, not really, you know, show up in conversations that often? Just give you a basic example. UBS Wealth Management, when we speak to a client, the first thing we say is, what are your goals? What's your strategic asset allocation? If you take a 5 to 7 year view, where do you want to be invested in? And normally about 80% of their portfolio would be in a combination of bonds and equities and 20% in private investments, so unlisted. So we just leave that to one side. But if the client asks me, okay, great, I'm interested in the long-term view, I want to be in emerging markets, full stop, how much of my portfolio will be emerging markets? I'll say, well, actually, even under current circumstances, we're a bit overweight. Probably you're looking at about 10% of your overall portfolio, so about half in equities and bonds. And the simple reason is there's just not that much, you know, out there. Right? If you look at the MSCI EM, which at best probably 2%, 3% of a client portfolio, 29% of that is in China alone, and we're not even talking, you know, Chinese onshore investments, at least not yet. You know, that will change in June. So now this is a two-way street. You know, one, of course, these markets are a bit too small right now, so they need to grow to allow accessibility. But also, from emerging markets' point of view, they have to think about the other side of the equation. Are emerging markets, and especially in Asia, is there a willingness actually to allow foreign investors to own a good chunk of your market? Because if you can own a good chunk, if they own a good chunk of your market, they can sell a good chunk of your market as well. So if you look at Japan, 92% of Japanese government debt is owned domestically. A good chunk of Italian debt is owned domestically. So that's why, despite a 245%, you know, gross debt to GDP ratio, Japanese 10-year yields still fund at zero or barely above zero, right? So there are pros and cons of attracting foreign investor inflow, both in terms of equities and bonds, but at the same time, you have to be able to push back or have the institutions, you know, have the defense mechanisms against preventing a route, you know, going outside of the market as well. So it's wide-held, you know, knowledge that if you want to, let's say, exit, you know, from a ASEAN bond position, it's not going to be instantaneous. You know, good luck getting out of that trade over the next 2 to 3 weeks or so, right? And we're talking about a relatively liquid market. So there's no silver bullet here. There's no comprehensive solution. But going back to the risks, I just want to focus on the investor risk, the liquidity risk. Yes, we're all hung up on the macro narrative right now, but we need to think about the longer term situation. If you want foreign investors to have confidence in your economy, you need to be willing to allow yourself to take the risks that they may lose confidence sometimes, but you have to gain it back. And that's just part of the learning process. We're focused too much on the macro side right now, but I think lots of opportunities over the medium to longer term. And hopefully in 5 years' time, I can come back and say EM is not 10% anymore. It's 15, 20%, if not higher. And ASEAN, a good chunk of that as well. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thank you very much. A couple of questions to ask on that. But Ying, let's come to you next for your remarks.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jonathan, and thank you to the LSE for having me. I'm going to take a slightly different perspective. So Global Council is a consultancy firm that works with businesses to navigate political and policy risk. So in my comments today, I'm going to focus on an issue that we end up discussing a lot with our clients. And I think that is actually one of the biggest political and economic risks that's facing ASEAN today. And it's the question that businesses often think about as a license to operate. And I think that it also exists for governments as well as a license to govern. And I think ultimately that it comes down to a question of the nature of the growth that Southeast Asia has achieved over the last 30 years, and actually the precariousness of that growth. So ASEAN has achieved incredible growth in the past 30 years, and in the process, it's lifted millions of people out of poverty. But if we look more closely at that growth, I want to argue that it's actually very precarious for a number of reasons. First, as we've seen over the past 2 weeks, governments are facing unprecedented uncertainty at the ballot box. I think that has implications for stability and for the way that markets view the region. Second, the growth that Southeast Asia has pursued over the last few decades is a model that's dependent on commodity exports, on trade, and on its ability to attract FDI. I think that, as we've heard this morning, the dynamics around each of those drivers of growth is currently in a state of flux. Third, demographics. We hear a lot about the rise of the Asian middle class, but actually, what do we mean by middle class? By some definitions, we're actually talking about people on incomes of as little as $2 a day. So there's no question that this group can be a significant driver of growth, but it's also a very vulnerable group. Then there's technology. Again, as we've heard, technology is reshaping the fundamentals of the way that these economies are structured and the way that they operate. But is it making them more or less stable and more or less equal? Then there's another question that I want to touch on around sustainability and the environment. I think that the push to exploit commodities has come at the cost of massive environmental degradation. And one example of this would be the haze crisis that you saw in ASEAN in 2015 in the wake of the forest fires in Indonesia, which caused up to $30 billion worth of damage, may lead up to 100,000 premature deaths, and emitted as much carbon as the whole of the US economy in that year. I think another similar episode would be a disaster for the region and would probably lead to riots. I think all of this ultimately comes down to a question about the unbalanced nature of growth and the fact that even as the economies of Southeast Asia continue to grow, social mobility is stagnating and in many places is in reverse. So perhaps I can just delve into a few of those points. To turn first to politics, Southeast Asia has a very diverse political landscape, but actually there are a few common denominators. Patronage tends to be the governing principle in politics. Corruption, to varying degrees, is endemic and in many places accepted as a way of life. Identity politics is on the rise, with people choosing to group themselves politically on the basis of their ethnicity or their religion. On top of this, the wave of populism that we've seen in the US and Europe is here in Southeast Asia as well. And actually, many of the drivers are the same. Concerns about growth and jobs, the perception that the dividends of growth have not been distributed equally amongst all citizens, and that decisions are being made by a closeted elite that is out of touch with the concerns of ordinary people. And then the other risk drifting in from across the Pacific, as we heard from Dr. Deborah Elms and others earlier, is the potential of a backlash against trade and against globalization. So since this question of trade and the FDI issue have been covered by other panelists, maybe I'll just jump to the other structural problems that I mentioned earlier. I want to interrogate first a little bit the idea of the so-called Asian middle class. So as I said, some define it as those earning over $2 a day, others those earning over $10. But either way, I think that my major point here is that the middle class is located overwhelmingly towards the bottom rung of the income ladder. And if you set the threshold at $20 a day, much of this middle class would pretty much disappear. So that means that actually the middle class that you're looking at in Asia is very different from what we have in the West, particularly because the majority of them don't enjoy the protection of a social safety net. That means that this group is economically very vulnerable, and a difference of a couple of dollars a day can tip them back over the edge and back towards poverty. I think that this explains the reason that you see the popularity of policies like the fuel subsidy in countries like Malaysia and Indonesia, even though they're very unpopular with economists. I think technology is another factor here, and it's changing the way that this middle class lives and works. This is really interesting for a number of reasons, but I think that the basic point here is that traditionally, one of the main reasons that the formation of a middle class has been a driver of economic growth is that it helps to build human capital. But if you look at the technological revolution happening in Southeast Asia at the moment, you have to ask, in what ways are Uber drivers or Gojek drivers in Indonesia actually building their human capital? How does employment of this kind, how is it going to help them to move up the income ladder and become more secure? And I think that actually the environment, some of the environmental scandals that we've seen in Southeast Asia over the past few years, like the Haze crisis, are a symptom of the same problem of inequitable growth. The big commodities firms have become extremely vulnerable to criticism at home and abroad, and it's not just because they're chopping down rainforests that are home to orangutans. I think the more acute problem, at least for their domestic audiences, is that there is a widespread perception that these businesses have enriched just a few families rather than the hundreds of thousands of small growers, suppliers at the bottom of their supply chain. There was a report by Oxfam last year that found that the four richest men in Indonesia had more wealth than the bottom 100 million combined. I think that sort of disparity is driving anger and it's driving instability. I think this predicament demonstrates the way in which Southeast Asia is at a turning point. It's achieved spectacular growth, but the gains of that growth for the majority are still extremely precarious. In particular, the stagnation of social mobility is going to be a huge economic and political challenge. If I were a political leader, my concern would be my government's ability to deliver growth at a rate and in a way which benefits the expectations of my electorate. I think the growing awareness of social equality is also creating a legitimacy crisis for corporates, and maybe this is something I can come back to later. These groups, governments, big corporations, wealthy families, have been the architects and the main beneficiaries of Southeast Asia's economic miracle. But if they fail to adapt, they face the same risk of disruption that UMNO did in Malaysia. So I think I'll leave it there and maybe come back.
I think we're going to have several things to come back to there. Thank you very much. Okay, next up, please, Peter.
Thanks very much, everyone. I'm delighted to be here to represent Eurasia Group, which is, like Global Council, a more political-focused, policy-focused institution, helping companies understand some of the dynamics in the region and what it means for them. So a little bit of what I say will be a little bit similar to Ying. I mean, we look at a whole range of risks, you know, from whether, you know, North Korea and the security situation in South China Sea, terrorism, cyber, automation. I'm not going to really touch on those. I'm going to highlight three that we're looking at particularly closely at the moment, although they're risks slash opportunities. We say we're a risks firm, but we also like to focus on opportunities as well. One is, and Ying's already mentioned this, identity politics. So we said in Eurasia Group's 2018 top 10 global risks, we had the sort of rise of identity politics or the intensification, because it already exists, of identity politics in Southeast Asia as one of our top 10 risks. And some people said to us, well, that's a bit crazy because you had the Jakarta election, you know, 2017, that's since subsided, so why are you now focusing on identity politics? Isn't that last year's issue? And we said, no, this would come to the fore during the Malaysia election, which it did. If you read some of the media reports talking about the Malaysia election, they'll say that this results sort of shows that the days of identity politics in Malaysia are over and this is a new wave of democracy and everyone loving each other, and I think we kind of dismiss that and think that's a rather optimistic view of what's happened in Malaysia. So you have identity politics there. You have Islamization in Indonesia and Malaysia. We've been doing a lot of work looking at the trend of rising Muslim populism in Indonesia and Malaysia. This is not a good or a bad thing. It's just something that's necessarily changing the dynamic in terms of the regulatory environment, and it's, you know, businesses need to be prepared for this. Buddhist nationalism in Myanmar is rising. And although these, Ying was saying, although these trends, they have a common kind of cause, which is concerns over rising inequality or the perception of rising inequality. Because actually, if you look at Gini coefficient data, inequality in a country like Indonesia has come down in recent years, but the public perception is that it's gone up. So that may be that the Gini coefficient is not very good at sort of capturing these, and that's a different debate. But all of these underlying trends, you know, growing inequality, concerns over that, but they're manifesting in very different ways. So if you're a company operating in these countries or you're an economy, the impact of Buddhist nationalism in Myanmar is very different to the impact of Islamization in terms of the business regulatory environment. But even between Indonesia and Malaysia, the impact of rising Muslim populism, and whether it's Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand, although it's getting a bit shakier, Cambodia, still in Malaysia, who are in a position to push forward reform. And we're seeing that in terms of the Philippines, against the fact that institutions, the UK FTA is on the horizon, But after that, we don't see much optimism. Most of the EU deals in Southeast Asia, unlikely to be many new ones after Singapore or Vietnam, at least for a long time. RCEP, as you're all aware of, is not really going anywhere. And as I said, ASEAN-owned integration initiative is sort of stalling a bit. And then, of course, the elephant in the room is China, and China-ASEAN integration is proceeding, but that is creating a lot of kind of risks as well as opportunities, both in terms of the domestic political impact of rising Chinese investment in the region, but also how is China shaping the rules that businesses have to operate in the region. And we're seeing this particularly in the tech sector. So one of our other kind of global top risks for 2018 was a US-China global tech war. But that US-China global tech war is really playing out in Southeast Asia, where there is a battle not just for market share from US and Chinese tech companies, but also to actually dominate and influence the regulatory environment by which all companies have to operate. I'll leave it there.
Peter, thank you very much. Cesar, some opening comments.
This morning, the Singapore ambassador started with a talk on ASEAN in a contested world. And the first risk that I'd like to talk about is the risk that we might lose the importance of, lose sight of the importance of the centrality of ASEAN amidst these various contests that is pulling ASEAN various ways. You know, the ASEAN's vision is to be the hub of intra-Asia trade, trade between North Asia and South Asia, trade between China through ASEAN amidst the historical animosities between these various regions. That is why ASEAN initiated all these trade agreements. In fact, among the various regions of the world, ASEAN has the highest percentage of trade under free trade agreement. Individually, each of the ASEAN countries are small, but because of getting together as ASEAN, it's been successful in trying to be that hub. It was mentioned in the panel just before about TPP-4 by Dr. Elms. In fact, TPP, as originally envisioned, was a threat to the centrality of ASEAN because only four of the ASEAN members were included. In fact, when I was still in government, I was advocating for the fact that TPP should engage the whole of ASEAN rather than just four countries, because if it became a reality, unfortunately it did not with the US, TPP would have split ASEAN apart because Vietnam, being part of the TPP, would immediately have, for example, a 20% tariff advantage over the other ASEAN countries that export garments to the US. No? So I think it's important that all the ASEAN countries do not lose sight of the fact that the centrality of ASEAN is what gives all of them a place in the table. Individually, except Indonesia, all the other ASEAN countries are small. The second risk that I want to talk about is concentration risk. Now, increasingly, because the US has been less active in the region and Japan's economy has been in doldrums, a bigger portion of ASEAN's trade is with China. And with the assertiveness of China, I think ASEAN will have to work hard to make sure that it continues to diversify its trade portfolio. Right now, ASEAN, if you look at China, if you look at Greater China as a trading partner of ASEAN, it's already the largest trading, or maybe equal to intra-ASEAN trade, accounting for about a quarter of ASEAN trade. And that's something that I think ASEAN countries will have to continue to monitor. The UK is one opportunity. We were chatting earlier during the break about the opportunities that the Brexit might offer the UK in engaging ASEAN. The third risk is complacency risk that I think we should continue to monitor because of the success of ASEAN the past 20 years, we might lose sight of the need to continue to reform the institutions, continue to reform structurally across ASEAN. And we might believing in ourselves that the success of ASEAN is preordained. It is not. For example, in my home country, I'm glad that the current administration is continuing to reform, for example, the tax structure of the country, because for the longest time, fiscal constraint has been one of the biggest constraints to growth of the Philippines. But within ASEAN, the so-called connectivity of ASEAN through infrastructure is still not a reality. And this is something that we all need to work together. That is why I'm identifying complacency risk as one of those risks that we should all keep in mind. Obviously, I don't want to repeat what the others mentioned, but to summarize, it's important that ASEAN consider the fact that together they're stronger. Individually, each one of them would be irrelevant. And this they have to keep in mind despite being pulled different directions by the powers of the world. And secondly, that they need to continue to diversify their trade engagement beyond their current set and not to overly concentrate their trade with those that they have right now. And third, to continue to work on the reforms that have gotten them where they are right now, but it's still not completed.
Cesar, thank you very much. A full gamut of risks we have. Jeffrey, if I could come back to you first of all, and I'd like to throw it open to questions from the audience quickly. But I mean, we always think when looking at the big indices in emerging markets, how significant Asia is. China, obviously, as you mentioned, and when the A shares come in, it's going to be even more significant. Very important in the debt indices as well. But as you say, very foreign dominated. Is there any sign in Asia or elsewhere, if you want, in emerging markets, but particularly in the region, of development of local markets that are going to have the kind of depth that can compensate for that?
If we're frank, you know, not really, and I don't know how much of a prioritization it's going to be, because you know that's kind of that kind of funds in when it comes to passive money, right? So sometimes governments will really question the economic value of it, right? So for example, is it going to be a hedge fund trading in and out, which may do more damage to financial stability than it's worth? I just sense the focus is more on attracting sticky money, as we say, FDI and both public and private sector investment, and also private investments. For example, I mentioned 80% of our clients' portfolios are listed instruments. That 20%, which we could classify as alternatives, could be hedge funds, could be real estate, it could be private equity. In particular, private equity, where your time horizon is 10 to 13 years, that is equally as valid. And some would even argue an environment where listed valuations, so equities and bond prices, are relatively high, it's the more private sector valuations that they want to attract. So there isn't a right answer to this. I think it comes to an individual country level. It comes to an individual sectoral level. Some sectors, they need sticky money. Some sectors, probably they need the proverbial kick up the backside from fast money to actually identify the mispricings. But you raise another interesting element there in terms of the indices. Should we also be asking, are indices and index definitions, index establishment, is that too so-called Western dominated? Whereas the EM alternative to MSCI, right? So where's the EM alternative to the ratings agencies, for example? I think that's a question that EM needs to answer itself.
The ratings agencies and the index providers, they're businesses, aren't they? If there's a demand, somebody would rise up to supply it. We'll come back to much of that. Ying, you talked about a bunch of fascinating stuff, but I mean the issue of whether the development of tech is leading to more or less inequality, and you talked of a legitimacy crisis that opens up for corporations. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that and how that affects particularly multinationals and what they should be wary of and what they can do?
Mm-hmm. So maybe just to start on tech, I think that the technological revolution is very distinctive in Southeast Asia compared to the West. And the main reason for that is that in the West, I think the tech revolution has really been driven by two things. One is discovery and innovation around labor-saving technologies. And the second one is moving away from the rigidity of a formal economy into more of a gig economy. I think in Southeast Asia, you're actually seeing the opposite. So whereas in the West, the formalization of the economy happened 100 years ago through the creation of big corporations and structures like unions, in Southeast Asia, technology is actually playing that role. So with something like Uber, which just recently sold its business in Southeast Asia to a local rival called Grab, or Gojek, which is basically like a version of Uber but for motorcycle drivers, you're actually bringing workers out of the informal economy and into the formal economy. So there's an opportunity there around, you know, for the first time you can understand the economic activities of these people, for the first time you can tax them, and also you can bring them some of the protections of a formal structure of systems and disciplines. But I do think that that tech also carries a risk. You know, there is always the concern around automation and whether it either it creates jobs or takes jobs away. But I think there is also the issue that I mentioned earlier about, is it actually building human capital? Is it actually building skills? Some of the backlash against this technological revolution, I think, was seen in the parliamentary hearings after Uber sold its business to Grab in Southeast Asia, and in the Singapore Parliament, people were asking, you know, is it responsible for a company to come in and say we're going to create tens of thousands of jobs and then suddenly disappear overnight? To come on to the problem of the corporate legitimacy crisis, I think that it's related to sort of what Peter said earlier about the perceptions of inequality. And I think that that perception is really driving anger against all sorts of groups in power. It's driving anger against governments and against state-owned corporations for the cozy relationships that they have with the ruling elite, the politicization of state-owned firms. I think for the family businesses, it's really the perception around the growth of this super-rich class and the extent to which they've enriched themselves at the cost of the rest of society. And I think for multinationals, I think it's also a question of, you know, there is increased scrutiny of their tax contributions, the contributions that they're making to employment, and also corporate governance issues. They've been caught up in some of the same corruption scandals that state-owned firms and family businesses have as well. So I think all of this builds up into a bigger question that corporates have to consider about their license to operate. And I think it's a longer term issue that it's going to take years to address.
Okay, Peter. Again, lots to talk about, but you were talking about trade within the region and mentioning that the momentum is falling in ASEAN, intra-ASEAN trade, I guess. I mean, we've... looking at figures just last week, in fact, about trade within emerging markets generally, and I think not very long ago we passed 60% of EM exports going to other EMs. So the idea being that emerging markets are able to sustain themselves more and being less dependent on demand from the developed world. Is ASEAN going against that tide, or what's the dynamic?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I probably should qualify my point by saying political momentum for trade integration. So I think in terms of the corporate sector, that continues. But in terms of the political drive for boosting trade integration, I mean, my concern with ASEAN is that we had the 2015 ASEAN Economic Community agenda, and that basically once that was announced as being largely have achieved at the end of 2015, and that was, the whole project was launched, then I think there was a bit of, as you were saying, a bit of complacency has stuck in, and people think, oh, we've launched the AEC now, even though a large part of it has not been done. Depending on who you talk to, it's sort of 60% hasn't been done or 10% hasn't been done. And I think politically there's been a lack of momentum post-2015, and there's huge challenges going forward. I think there has been, you know, some people have been distracted because some countries have been more focused on TPP or bilateral FTAs. There's also a lack of, I would say, it's a lack of political leadership. I think one of the problems I've said with the ASEAN integration process is, to a large extent, most of what happens is dependent on the three most pro-integration countries, Singapore, Malaysia, and Thailand, really driving this agenda. Singapore politically is in a difficult position. It can't put itself out there as a kind of leader, although it's chairing ASEAN this year. So it needs to have the support of Thailand and Malaysia working with it to really argue the case for deeper integration. But you've had, until last week or 2 weeks ago, the Malaysian leader distracted by various other things, not least trying to stay in power, and dealing with certain scandals, and they're really not able to exert much of a leadership role. Actually, one of the positives of Mahathir coming back is that he may inject a bit more momentum into the regional integration process, because his track record on that area is pretty good. In Thailand, you know, Thailand traditionally has been a big push driver of kind of regional integration, but for the last few years, obviously, they've been completely engrossed with introspective social divides and politics. So no one is playing that leadership role. I mean, Indonesia, of course, is the biggest country in the region, but it sets the pace from the back, not the front, in terms of integration. So who's really driving this agenda? And I think that's the kind of fundamental question that has to be answered.
Okay, and well, both of you talked about China, the elephant in the room, and its role in the region. China, as we know, has its Belt and Road Initiative, which can very easily be seen as an attempt to keep the old economy going outside China's borders. If you've run out of infrastructure investment that you can do at home, then you do it overseas. And Central Asia and Southeast Asia play a big part in that, and there are investments that they definitely want to do. You're suggesting that governments in the region should be worried about becoming less integrated with China rather than more. So what kind of tensions is that going to deliver geopolitically, and how do you think governments in the region will deal with that?
Well, for one, you know, the track record of China in terms of being a reliable partner is not yet fully established. And two, from a financial standpoint, the stability of the currency long term will pose a major financial risk.
Of the renminbi will pose a
financial risk for the countries that do borrow in yuan, because right now the currency is not yet fully open. I remember 30 years ago when the Philippines started borrowing from Japan, or 40 years ago, we borrowed at 400 something. And suddenly, 20, 30 years later, we had to pay at 100 plus yen to the dollar, multiplying our debt several fold. That can happen again. And that is why I believe that we should engage China, but I think we have to do it with our eyes open and make sure that we diversify our sources of trade, our sources of financing, to make sure that we are not overly exposed.
And if you resist overexposure to China, does that mean that somebody else has to become a major partner of the region outside?
Well, the good thing that's happening right now, as mentioned in the earlier session, is that with the vacuum created by the U.S., Japan has been actually trying to step up. No? In the case of Philippines-Japan, during the previous administration, our relationship was actually quite good, and their commitment was quite substantial. But in the current administration, they've even increased it further because of the fact that if not, you know, the vacuum that the U.S. created will be occupied by China in itself. So there is this competition that's going on right now. I think ASEAN should take advantage of it by, you know, creating that competitive tension. But we should not limit it to China and Japan. I think we should start engaging India, which is the natural counterpoint in Asia for China, but even Europe, including the UK, especially after UK leaves EU.
All right, I'd like to open it. We've got one hand up already. That was quick, well done, because others are following. If you would just mind, I don't think do we need microphones? We've got a microphone. If you would just identify yourself when you answer a question here in the pale jacket.
Yeah, James Putzel. I'm a professor of development studies here at the school, in the International Development Department, and associate of this research center. I have a general question for everybody and a question for the Honorable Parisima. And I'm happy to see you're now on academic base for a while. So there's an awful lot of demonology about China. And on the other hand, Southeast Asian businesses have profited enormously from China's growth, right? So, and in the Philippines, that's been particularly so over the years since the opening up of China. And so I'm very I'm very curious to hear your reflections about something Jonathan mentioned at the beginning, these mini currency markets. We started to get onto it just now with Cesar Purisima talking about the currency risk, but it's very interesting, the dynamics and the politics, the political economy of currency. Of course, currencies of exchange have always been in the hands or backed by the largest military power in the world, if we look historically. And of course, it's very strategic now what strategic commodities are priced in, so energy. But we see these dynamics being pushed by the kind of very large shift in US policy towards the potential of at least partial currency exchanges emerging. The commodities, strategic commodities, become priced in something other than dollars. Of course, there's a long way to go with that, but I'd love to hear your reflections about how that's happening, because that's your domain much more than mine. And then for Cesar Purisima, it seems to me that if we, you know, I'm studying international development, doing research in other places outside the region, if you look at Africa, the countries that have benefited most from China's investment are those where the state has a real development kind of plan and priorities. And it seems to me the Philippines has enormous opportunities vis-a-vis China that are untapped. We talk about the kind of growth the Philippines has had. It's been very much a jobless growth. The possibilities now for new infrastructure investment, for perhaps stepping up production capacity in the Philippines' position in different value chains is really very present. And of course, very risky if you have no strategic idea of where the country should go. So I'd love to have your reflections now that you've stepped back from being a very effective finance minister, but on the bigger picture of where the Philippines is going.
Okay, thanks very much. Could we just start with Jeffrey? One thing that I'd like to add to that question on the regional element. As China's shares start to come into the MSCI and other indices, and we start to see more people buying mainland China shares, will we also see a significant amount of Chinese money investing outside China in the equity and other portfolio markets, and is that part of the dynamic?
Got it. Thanks. So this goes to the process of renminbi internationalization, right? So, you know, how significant is that going to be, and in what shape or form is that going to be? To be honest, I don't think China itself knows what renminbi internationalization is going to look like. But I think we can see a narrative like this year developing. If you look at developments over the last 2 months or so, where the US, for the first time, has actually shown it has leverage. It doesn't have leverage in terms of, I would say, tariffs or, you know, trade barriers or and things like that. You know, as Peter mentioned, I think it's more the regulatory side, you know, where it matters more. But the dollar is the ultimate big stick, you know, that the Economist, you know, pointed out, you know, over the weekend. Having access, you know, shut down to the payment system, to the dollar-driven global financial system, you know, that is a risk, and we're seeing that. Russian companies can't even get their stock prices, you know, listed on Bloomberg, you know, for example, for fear of sanctions violations. That is proper leverage. That inhibits price discovery, and then investors will say, I'm going to sell first, and then ask questions later. You know, ZTE's shares are still suspended. It's almost been a month now, and that has led to liquidity risks, you know, within China. So China needs to decide whether they want renminbi to be like the dollar, or they just want an alternative to the dollar, because these two are different things, right? So, you know, why... the people have been talking up the UK, you know, as an alternative, as a hub for renminbi internationalization. Has it really happened? Because ultimately, if it's an international currency, you need to allow all sorts of counterparties to actually access your currency. And this actually, you know, brings us to Jonathan's you know, question about renminbi flow outside. And the key missing link here is there's a lack of willingness to allow Chinese money to actually go overseas, right? So why is it that Chinese, when they make their money within China, perhaps, then the next phase is, how do I open a bank account in, you know, Switzerland or Singapore? You know, Singapore and Hong Kong have been massive beneficiaries of that capital outflow, right? So what I fear is, you know, this renminbi internationalization process may start to look like what Hong Kong and London has become. Yes, it is a market, but it is a market in which the participants are only the people the Chinese government are comfortable with. You limit entry, you have barriers there. Then in that sense, I think people always revert back to the dollar. Right? So I'm still quite skeptical. Yeah.
China also has leverage on the US dollar, you know, because of how much it
buys. I totally push back against that argument because that does far more harm to China than anything else. If China sells US treasuries, let's say, okay, limit order this afternoon, 200 billion yours, the market, Fed will say, the SOMA desk in the US will say, thank you very much, absorbed immediately, right? But then what does that do to the renminbi? Suddenly your reserves are down, let's say, by 10, 15%. That's open season for foreign speculators to short the renminbi, and then the Chinese money will go out, right? So this, I know the press likes to play it back, but I think deep down, and especially you've got two former heads of the State Administration of Foreign Exchange running the PBOC and the regulators, by the way, they know more than anyone else this is false leverage unless you want to actually, it's cutting off your entire face to spite your brain or whatever, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the road to internationalization looked very attractive to start with, didn't it? And then I think they ran up against some quite significant bumps. Ying, do you want to talk about renminbi internationalization?
No, I think I'll
do it. Peter, that leaves you. Do you want to talk about where we are in the dynamic and what has happened so far and whether China wants to go to the next step?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I completely agree with what was just said by Jeffrey. I mean, our China team's take is that doing something with sort of offloading debt holdings to try and undermine the dollar is completely counterproductive. So, first of all, completely agree with that. On RMB internationalization, I'm slightly biased because when I used to work for the British government, I actually was in Beijing and negotiated with other colleagues the agreement to get London as an offshore RMB center. So I think it's been a huge success. But in terms of Asia, I mean, certainly in Southeast Asia, if you compare with a few years ago, I would say there's a lot less focus on it. But I mean, that's partly inevitable because a few years ago, it was seen as a one-way bet on the currency. And that sort of one-way bet has disappeared. So I think part of the market dynamic has gone away with that, and also a reluctance to kind of settle. What's also interesting, actually, on the currency is a few Southeast Asian countries are now trying to push the idea of settling trade in their own currencies within Southeast Asia. And it'll be really interesting to see. I think it's Thailand, Philippines, and Indonesia. And it'll be interesting to see how that sort of takes off.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, that's one of the reasons that the dollar is such a big stick, is because even if you don't do any trade with the United States, you're still trading in the dollar.
Yeah.
This is the first I've heard of any intention to have commodities priced in regional currencies. Is that anybody else heard of that coming along?
Well, the starting point is, you know, now you can, gold futures have been available in Shanghai for some time now, denominated in renminbi. Oil futures have just started, so that's something that the rest of the world is, especially our Middle Eastern clients, actually quite excited about. But the point is, you need to have a framework whereby all international players are comfortable. Take China, out of this. Say the Philippines will be willing to, buy Qatari oil for renminbi. Qatar then will buy food from Turkey using renminbi, and then Turkey buys high value add components, from Germany and renminbi. These are all places, with renminbi clearing, by the way. And then Germany will, use renminbi to, do whatever it needs to do with China or someone else, right? So can you have a framework? So like 50% of, Japanese, exporters, they invoice in dollars, right? So, they made a conscious choice to just remove the yen. It's too volatile, I think, from their point of view. But they made a conscious choice a long time ago to remove the yen from the invoicing framework. And again, that's a sign of internationalization for currency.
We have seen a lot of volatility in the dollar, haven't we? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the broad index particularly, it really, the last couple of years, it's swung dramatically. And we're seeing now, I mean, just last week, we saw the knock-on effect very quickly. People wake up very suddenly to changes that they may have seen coming, but as they start to have an impact, people react very quickly. Cesar, would you like to address renminbi globalization or go straight to your...
Well, I guess I go straight to the question that was asked of me specifically. Even during the Aquino administration, the trade relations between the Philippines and China was quite healthy, actually. It was the fastest growing component of our trade because we were part of a global supply chain. In fact, the trade within ASEAN is really mostly intermediate goods that ultimately end up in China and then to the US. But yes, you're correct that during the previous administration, because of the tension involving the territories, we have not been able to maximize, or we were not able to maximize the benefits of the relationship with China. For example, for tourism, we were capped at about 200,000 tourists, whereas our neighbors were in the tens, even higher, a million tourist arrival. But ever since the rapprochement that was initiated by the current administration, our tourists, China's tourist arrivals have gone to almost a million and is expected to continue to increase. Yes, there is definitely a benefit to engaging China. My point earlier, which was I was talking not of the Philippines per se, but ASEAN as a whole, is that there is a need to make sure that we are not overly concentrated with China, because there's a risk of a hard landing for China, given all its issues involving some of the debts of the local Chinese governments and state-owned companies. And therefore, making sure that we're not overly concentrated, I think, bodes well for the health of ASEAN as a whole. That was the point that I was trying to say.
A question in the back row there. I think somebody's lost the circulation in their hand.
Hi, Sam Gill, China Dialogue. I wanted to build on the good point that I think Ying Statton wrote about the environmental risks, or the environmental component of sustainability and resilience in Southeast Asia. And maybe to ask you to build on that, or others to come in, on the climate change and energy sort of aspect of that question, beyond just the likelihood of increased local environmental events that cause social stability risks and so on. I think there's slightly longer term and more uncertain risks associated with climate change in the region, be it increased tropical storm risks, the extent to which, you know, there are a lot of low-lying coastal areas with heavy urbanization and poor infrastructure. These kinds of questions, I think, are quite significant. And then the other thing that's closely related is the increased investment in high carbon infrastructure at the moment, which does pose an economic risk in terms of stranded assets. If you see investments, say, in new coal-fired generation with renewable energy, the cost of renewable energy falling very fast, with likely climate policies coming in around the world, the risk that there you're actually sort of creating a risk of stranded assets, I think, is significant and maybe part of that conversation. Thanks.
Ying, let's go to you first. What sort of momentum is there behind efforts to tackle environmental considerations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that Southeast Asia is actually at the forefront of a whole range of issues around climate change and sustainability. I think energy and dependence on coal is definitely one. Forestry is another. I think you're seeing in the EU in particular a huge backlash against the use of palm oil in a whole range of different products, with supermarkets like Iceland leading the efforts on a ban. There's also an issue around sustainability in the oceans as well. So you see a number of governments in the region launching efforts to tackle illegal fishing and the depletion of fish stocks in Indonesia and in Thailand. I think actually waste management is another one that's come up in the last 12 months or so with that documentary, A Plastic Ocean, and the wave of concern around plastics has definitely swept through ASEAN as well. And I think in Indonesia in particular, that it's the second largest plastics polluter after China. And the government under the Coordinating Ministry of Maritime Affairs is launching a big effort to look at solutions for plastic management. So I agree. I think it is a huge challenge, partly because of just how embedded into the economy and into politics some of these industries are. So if you look at palm oil, for example, I mentioned that there is this perception that it's enriched a few families at the expense of hundreds of thousands of smallholders. But actually, these hundreds of thousands of smallholders are still dependent on the industry, and they're still dependent on palm oil for a livelihood. So to shut down that market overnight is definitely not going to happen. What we actually need to see is a longer process of reform. And I think similarly in fisheries, this is the Indonesian government has taken some very strong measures, things like blowing up illegal Chinese fishing boats. And I think that you are starting to see some results of that with fishery stocks starting to recover. And I think that actually there are lots of opportunities for investment coming out of these environmental challenges. And one example is that I think Indonesia was the first Asian country to launch a sovereign green bond last year. So I think just in sum, I agree it's a huge challenge, but there are also opportunities in there as well.
Geoffrey, we get an awful lot of press releases arriving on environmental, social, and governance as an opportunity.
Mostly from us, right?
As an opportunity for investors. I mean, is there any traction to that?
Yes, and we're especially seeing interest from the second and third generation of our clients. When it comes to wealth planning, we try to educate our investors not only to think about their own portfolios, but succession planning and what their future generations are interested in. UBS Wealth Management, we are committed to targeting having 5 billion Swiss francs worth of client money invested in ESG compliance solutions, whether be it as an inclusive or an exclusive process. But I would say, client buy-in, right now there is interest, but the key point is this: they will ultimately always ask the question, I'm willing to invest in, let's say, compliant stocks or companies, will this come at a cost to my overall returns, right? And often you will find, even for the most, let's just say, green client, so to speak, there is a threshold at which, if the gap between conventional investment and green investment is too much, they will actually take a step back. So I think that is the main challenge too.
What about in private markets?
So that includes, I would say, in private markets, but private markets is a bit harder to calibrate. But I would say in the alternatives bucket, people do look at long-term themes, long-term investments, emerging market healthcare, emerging market sustainability, so green investments, for example. A lot of that is happening in the private space. A lot of money is being poured there. And again, given where valuations in listed markets, right now, most investors are keener in terms of private markets, but they're sometimes harder to access. But again, going back to your earlier question about what kind of funds to ASEAN countries and EM in general want to attract, this is probably one key area where there is rising interest.
Can I just add very quickly to that? Yes. Yeah. I think that the interesting thing that Geoffrey mentioned about second and third generation investors, you actually also see the same shift in mindset in the second and third generation of the leaders of these family businesses that I talked about in Southeast Asia. So often these are people in their 30s and 40s who are now coming to the helm of their family businesses, which have been built on commodities. They have a much more cosmopolitan outlook. They've been educated overseas. They're actually much more concerned about these issues of sustainability and the long-term viability of their family businesses. So I think that the fact that this generation is now taking over is a huge opportunity for reform of these industries in Southeast Asia.
The other part of the question was about coal. We also get a lot of press releases and people contacting us about how green coal is becoming, especially in India.
Just a general question on a point on this. I personally think it's very varied in terms of the commitment to environmentalism and sustainability in Southeast Asia. There's a lot of very positive talk. There's a lot of focus on trying to seize the opportunities. So every country in Southeast Asia is trying to get to the forefront of electric vehicle production, for example. Indonesia is a good example, but when you really look at the policy frameworks and think, are they really going to offer these import preferential tariffs for electrical vehicle components, or are the protectionist trade minister and other people going to have more influence to prevent that? I say probably. Are they going to offer these tax incentives to develop electric vehicles, or are they going to think raising revenue is more important? Probably the latter. So when you start to unpick a lot of these initiatives, I think it looks a bit more skeptical about how genuinely committed. I think two exceptions. One, Vietnam, where I think pollution, and I say local pollution rather than climate change,
local pollution, like in China, has become an issue that is perceived as being a threat to the party's own survival, but it's very focused on local pollution. It's not necessarily looking at climate change as an issue, and green finance is something that Vietnam is pushing very strongly. Likewise, in the Philippines, you know, under President Duterte, he's seen environmental populism as something which can make him popular, and he actually went against most expectations and kept a ban on open pit mining. In terms of coal, having just said Vietnam's a country that's a bit more committed to an environmental agenda, their electricity production plan over the next 10 years or so has a massive ramp up of electricity production, and it not only sees an increase in absolute use of coal, but an increase in proportional use of traditional coal as well. So I think fundamentally, energy is one of the areas in ASEAN where demand is booming, and they are struggling to meet that demand. And I think ultimately some of the environmental good intentions will be put to aside to try and meet the electricity production demand.
So the whole issue of infrastructure investment and the carbon impact of that is big in the issue for the Philippines right now. Is it taking account of those considerations?
It does, but the challenge for, say, the country like the Philippines is that we have historically high power cost, and the cheapest right now, short term, is still coal. So you're really torn between, going green, and at the same time trying to be more competitive from the power cost standpoint. And this is where I think governments, not just the Philippines, but across the globe, must get together to really tip the balance in favor of the cleaner forms of energy. And this is where I think the weakness of our current accounting system exposes us, because the current accounting system doesn't really do complete cost accounting of the impact of carbon to the environment. And that is why it cannot just be a unilateral action, say, of one country or the other. If you look at ASEAN, which is right now a net importer of energy, its most abundant form of fuel is coal. And that is where, in its developmental programs and its rush to improve its people's lives, the easy option is really to continue with coal.
We had another. Okay, let's have one in the middle here, please.
Thanks. David Brenner, lecturer in International Relations, University of Surrey. I wanted to probe a bit more the kind of connection between inequalities, perceived inequalities, and identity politics. So you were saying that some of the inequalities might actually not be that real because they're perceived maybe more like, or at least like data, Gini coefficient data doesn't back it up, right, Peter? And you were also, of course, saying that maybe the Gini coefficient isn't the right measurement for this, which is obviously true because it only kind of looks at inequalities between individuals, not groups, right? So we're talking about identity politics, and you'd have other measures for looking at group inequalities and polarization. What would be your kind of expected findings, I would think?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So definitely there's obviously inequality between certain groups. I think the way I like to phrase is you've got two things. You've got the kind of Islamization of politics, which is driven by genuine concerns over inequality, and then what I would call the politicization of Islam, and you saw this in Jakarta election, where people are whipping up a sentiment and trying to make claims about inequality being much greater than it is. So there's obviously inequality there. There's obviously genuine concerns about that, but there are political people, opponents of President Jokowi in Indonesia, who are willing to whip up fears that the majority Muslim indigenous population are being deprived of something that they should have, and they're doing that for political purposes, right? And you saw that most obviously during the Jakarta election, where you obviously had the former governor, a Christian ethnic Chinese, but one of the people that was supposedly, and is accused, of being behind that campaign to oust him was someone like Harry Tan Oh, a very rich businessman who happens to be ethnic Chinese and Christian himself, but was willing to put a lot of money into Islamist groups to try and get them out and onto the street and to say that this is terrible, these Christians are getting all these. So there's a very complicated picture is what I'm trying to say. So there are genuine concerns over rising inequality, but they're also being exploited in the same way that, I don't like to use the term fake news, but it does seem to be like a fake news campaign in Indonesia where political opponents of Jokowi on the social media saying there's millions of illegal Chinese workers in Indonesia, and there's absolutely no evidence for that. But this is getting a lot of traction, where people think, actually, I can't get a job because there's, you know, illegal Chinese workers doing that. And there's no evidence of that, but it's a perception. And once people have that perception, it becomes politically very potent. And that's the sort of dirty tricks that the political opponents are doing. So there's genuinely something there, but it's being inflamed and exacerbated and exploited by political opponents. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, I think maybe I'll just quickly comment that I think that the Gini coefficient, you know, isn't really at the forefront of people's minds when they're heading to the ballot box. The more critical issue is around the cost of living, as I mentioned earlier. So that's why you see that in the Malaysian elections, for example, the abolition of GST was such a big issue. And similarly, fuel subsidies. You know, when Jokowi first came into office, he expended a huge amount of political capital, basically eliminating the fuel subsidy. And now, heading into the next election, it looks like he's going to bring it back. So I think that it's really a function of the fact that you do have this huge proto-middle class that's actually living very precariously. And any cost of living increase will be felt very strongly by them because they don't have that confidence in their own income. I think that I agree with Peter that it does also drive the rise of identity politics. Part of the reason that the Malays in Malaysia, feel so strongly about their Malay rights and the whole kind of Bumiputra regime is down to the same lack of confidence in their own income. And I think as long as you have that, these cost of living debates and GST and fuel subsidy will continue to be a huge issue for politics in Southeast Asia.
Can we have a question here at the front, please?
Meredith Weiss, State University of New York. My question actually follows precisely upon this one, which it also addresses the issue of inequality. I agree that it is probably the most salient political issue across many of the states of Southeast Asia. I wouldn't agree that Islamization, for instance, is quite so tightly linked with inequality, but at the same time, I do think that the sort of corrosive cynicism building effect of it does encourage people to look for other options. Thinking in terms of what Ying mentioned of the decline in political legitimacy, when you have states that have built their political legitimacy solely around performance, places like Singapore that have no other identifiable ideological line at this point, and Malaysia, that's been an issue as well, you do have a question then of what is a viable political solution or where there's political will or political capital to pursue another way. The dominant state response through much of the region has been subsidies, as you note, cash transfers of different forms, Philippines, Malaysia, Singapore, and so forth, and reliance on the gig economy has been the latest thing of, you know, the sort of endless capacity to absorb labor, but as you've mentioned, in a tenuous way, and in many ways increasing precarity. So it makes those workers legible to the state, but it doesn't convey the benefits that legibility might be expected to have. So it makes them taxable for the first time without necessarily allowing, you know, time off for being sick or pensions, you know, those sorts of benefits. My question is really, what's the solution? It doesn't seem that there are states that have a clear ability. There's much more of a, you know, sort of a ready political payoff for putting in place a subsidy than for actually addressing the root causes. Is there a role for corporate actors or investors, for instance, even though it would in some way seem to go against their short-term self-interests, to invest in more equality-producing development rather than income, you know, sort of more immediate bottom-line producing or benefiting development? What do you see bright spots in the region of initiatives that actually aim to address root causes of inequality in a more sustainable way that are not simply things that have to be reversed at the next election because they're too expensive? And who is driving that?
Yes, so maybe I will just use one example. Yes, I do think that there are bright spots, and I do think that the private sector and investors have a role to play, in particular in the creation of a more effective social safety net that also brings services, to basic services to more people. And the example I want to use is a really interesting tech startup in Indonesia called HelloDoc. So the company was founded by a guy who was part of a family who owned one of the largest chains of pharmacies in Indonesia. And he noticed the basic problem that sales of pharmaceuticals are restricted by access to doctors, so you're not getting prescriptions, and also by the fact that you have this giant archipelago of 17,000 islands, and 90% of the population live outside of Jakarta, whereas I think 90% of the doctors and the specialists live in Jakarta. So they created this platform, which basically allows you to have an e-consultation with a doctor, and that doctor, and the cost of that consultation is 75% cheaper than the average face-to-face consultation. And you know, this in a country like Indonesia, where I think the number of doctors per 10,000 members of the population is 3, compared to a global average of 14 and 28 in the UK, for instance, this technology has been transformative. And then after you get the consultation, you get the prescription, a Gojek driver will go and pick up your medication from your nearest supplier, and that might be a pharmacy, or it might be, you know, a family mart or a mom and pop shop, and it will bring you that prescription. And the average time taken for delivery is just under 4 hours. So this company has been going for about 2 years. They've already signed up about 20% of the doctors in Indonesia. And you can imagine the potential if it were to be adopted in more countries. So I would say, yes, there are bright spots, and I think that this is actually one of the areas where technology could play a really positive and transformative role.
Sure, quite a few things you touched on. First of all, linking inequality and Islamization, I agree with you. I mean, what we say is really it's in an environment where there are, as you were saying, the concerns over cost of living, concerns over inequality, them versus us politics, whether it's in the UK, the US or Indonesia, come into fore, because people come along with a simple explanation that, oh, that's because another group are taking all of it, that's why. But in Islamization, another big factor, and I'm not going to go in depth, is obviously the role of Saudi Arabia, you know, and the money it's pumped into Indonesia, building madrasas, promoting a more conservative form of Islam, etc. So there's other factors to play as well. In terms of bright spots, I would put Philippines as a bright spot. Actually, I think the tax reform that was pushed through at the end of last year is largely redistributive. You can say some of it's regressive, things like sugary taxes, you can have a whole debate around that. But generally, it shifts the burden off the poor onto the more wealthy. And that was actually, for all the criticism of Duterte, he actually used his political strength to push through a tax reform. Indonesia, although there are some cash transfers, although subsidy reform has stopped, it's not going as far as Mahathir in reversing it. And actually, we predicted post-Jakarta election and Islamization, we said health spending is going to go up. And people thought, where's the link with that? And we said, because now inequality is now Jokowi's number one priority, and he's going to address this through ramping up health. He's not going to focus on cash or subsidies mainly. He'll stop reform. And he's done that, and a massive ramping up of health spending. So that's potentially a bright spot, boosting social service provision rather than, you know, relying on distortive subsidies. But unfortunately, Malaysia's going the other way. And, you know, post-Malaysia election, we've downgraded our medium-term outlook from Malaysia from positive to neutral. Because we see, although it's basically a nostalgic vote to go back to the 1990s at a time of more of a kind of dependency and comfortable culture, but we think, to get to the nub of your question, what you really need is fundamental structural reform. You need to break up the role of the SOEs. You need to, you know, this group of vested interests, the big families that control everything. That's the root cause of the inequality. And unfortunately, in some countries, like Malaysia just now, they've opted to go for a short-term fix, which in the long run is going to be bad news for the country.
Cesar, are you an optimist?
She was asking for examples. In the Philippines, there are good examples of corporations using their purchasing budget to actually make a difference. For example, Jollibee used to import all their tomatoes and onions because that was the easiest thing to do. But using their purchasing budget, they've helped farmers grow the right tomatoes and onions, such that they now don't import any tomato and onions. Nestle does that with coffee, Unilever does that with coconut. So there are good examples of how corporates can help narrow the inequality equation. But ultimately, I think it's really up to enlightened fiscal policy. In the Philippines, we've had this conditional cash transfer program, and he cited the reforms in our tax system that will further broaden that, so that that will increase our ability to support that program. But ultimately, as technology destroys jobs, I think enlightened policy will have to require countries to tax technology, so that then you can ultimately have the resources to retrain and help people re-enter the job market. That's the only way you can do that.
Okay, I think we can take one more question. Should we go over to the other side?
Hi there. My name is Jack Broom. I'm a conflict studies master's student at LSE. I wanted to expand on this question of the spread of political Islam in Southeast Asia. And I know we've now spoken quite a bit about inequality as a factor behind it. But there have been several other theories for instance, in the southern Philippines, looking at the traditional the traditional networks made up by the ethnic minorities in places like the Sulu Archipelago, as a different explanation to, and also not they're not linked to, they're not very well founded, for instance, in the ideology of Islam. They're much more linked to banditry and opportunist crime. The same we're looking at southern Philippines, and people have tried to put this this kind of veil of political Islam on that there too, but yet the type of terrorist activity seen in southern Philippines has not occurred there yet. So my question is, other than Islamization, what kind of alternate explanations to the rise of so-called Islamist terrorism in Southeast Asia do you see? And also the factors behind it, if it's not just inequality, what other factors do you see is driving that?
Cesar, could I go to you first?
Well, I'm not an expert on this area, but one thing I do know, the areas where we have the most trouble in terms of religious issues are the poorest areas. They have the highest mortality rates. They're the least developed economically. And I don't know whether that's a chicken or an egg issue, but clearly countries and governments will have to deal with this by making sure that the development opportunities across those regions are offered, so that you give them options and not to latch on to extremist ideas. That's the only thing I can say. And that is why Mindanao is a priority development area for the country.
Would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very difficult question to answer, but I mean, in terms of, you're right, there's obviously a difference between political Islam and some of the terror incidences which you're talking about, because we're talking about sort of mainstream political Islam and how that impacts on the regulatory environment. But in cases like Marawi and Mindanao, you largely had, it's not so much because the environment politically, nationally, was becoming more Islamic, it's because you have a dispute, a local dispute, which foreign fighters were drawn into. And it became a rallying call for Islamists around the region. I mean, what's interesting is if you look at the foreign fighters who came into Mindanao, most of them came from Southeast Asia, including places like Singapore and Malaysia even, rather than, say, from Syria and further afield, as was expected. But likewise, you have, and we said this, one of the things with the Rohingya situation, which is also, you know, obviously a terrible humanitarian crisis, but has been a rallying call for jihadists. So they will look for opportunities to exploit where there are sources of conflict where they can go in and sort of push their cause. But I think we always have to be quite careful to separate the security stuff from the political Islam debate. There is a bit of overlap, of course, but they're two quite separate things, I think.
Okay, I think we can actually take one more. Is there another question over here at the back?
You briefly mentioned about the political implications. I'm Panupong from the University of Cambridge. I would like to direct my question to Mr. Peter Mumford. You briefly mentioned about the political implications of the ASEAN and China integration in terms of that China has shaken the rules of investment within the region. So given the rising influence of China and the US retreat under the Trump administration, I generally assume that this generally undermines the regulatory environment within the region in terms of good governance and intellectual property rights, and let's say labor and environmental standards. So my question is, it is possible that any other international players like the EU or, let's say, Japan, in the absence of the US administration, can feel the welcome in upholding the regulatory regime within the region, and to what extent can they do so?
Great question. I mean, certainly, yeah, the sort of demise of the rules-based system in the region is one of the things that I lie awake worrying about at night. Only half joke as well. So the you know, you have to look at it. So China's role is growing, and obviously they have a different system. Russia, very few people talk about Russia, but Russia's influence in Southeast Asia is growing. It's nothing like China or Japan, that level. But Russia has been extending its tentacles into Southeast Asia. You know, obviously President Duterte has been a strategic opening for them. Also Thailand as well, and they have a long-standing relationship with Vietnam. And Russia has two things that ASEAN wants, which is weapons and energy. So, you know, Russia and China's influence growing, and then you have a US which is disengaged and has a less focused on a rules-based system and a values. The important point to note in that, there are several governments in Southeast Asia who are very happy to have a US administration that doesn't promote values, so it's not like a downside for everyone. But that's on the column against pushing for a rules-based system. And then I think on the other ledger, you have to put Japan, and obviously Japan's efforts to push the TPP and get TPP to survive without the US shows that it is playing a strong leadership role in trying to support rules in the region. You have EU, EU doesn't really play, I'm afraid to say, a massive role. Its FTAs help shape the rules in those particular countries it's investing in, or sort of has deals with, but that's only two so far, Singapore and Vietnam. It doesn't really have a big influence on the broad rules in the region. And then you have to look at individual governments. So, you know, until recently, most of the domestic governments have been moving away from a rules-based system, and governance across the board has been sort of weakening, whether it's in the Philippines, even Indonesia, the signs of growing sort of authoritarianism and undermining kind of institutions and governance. I would say Mahathir's victory in this area is probably quite a good thing. He has more focus on a rules-based system than his predecessor. Including sort of internationally in the region. You know, he's supportive of binding China. I think the media perceptions of him being anti-China or anti-Chinese investment are wrong. I think he just wants to make sure it benefits more than it's done within the norms of a kind of regional rules-based system. And so he once said, actually, China should join the TPP, and that would be a great thing. And so he's more in favor of binding China into kind of the rules of the region. So I think you have to look at the ledger. At the moment, it's the people who are against the rules-based system are much stronger. The question is, does, you know, re-election of Mahathir, does Japan's push? And then, you know, how long is Trump going to be US president? Who knows? And maybe the next US president will be more in favor of a rules-based system, but it may be too late by then.
Ying, would you like to add to that?
Maybe only briefly that I think that actually the key defining characteristic of ASEAN as a bloc is its ability to maintain that diversity of interests and that diversity of relationships. And in fact, that it's very accustomed, all the countries in ASEAN, very accustomed to playing one great power off against the other. So I don't think it's a question of China withdrawing and someone else coming to take up that vacuum or the US doing the same. It's more a question of how ASEAN manages the balance between all of those relationships.
Jeff.
If I could just add, we've got to be careful in falling into the trap of saying rules-based system equals good, i.e. more rules are good, right? Rules are there to protect certain interest groups sometimes. There's a reason why the US tax code is 4,700 and whatever pages, right? So because of the exemptions and here and there. If US had a tax code saying every person or company will pay 15% tax, end of. Right, that's pretty straightforward. So sometimes, I'm not saying we need a race to the bottom or implicitly the inclusion of China means a race to the bottom or anything like that. You know, China will need protection from rules as it did during the WTO framework as well. Rules sometimes need to be pro-cyclical, they need to be counter-cyclical, right? So the fact that Trump seems to be tearing up the rules-based or the existing rules-based framework, you know, that is being pictured as bad, but I think we have to take a step back sometimes and say, actually, were the rules the right rules? Having so many rules, was that a good place? Was that a good framework in the first place? Sometimes you need animal spirits, right? Because that generates economic growth. And then when you have the growth, you have the wealth. People need rules, institutions to actually protect the wealth and then build on that, right? So I think the narrative sometimes needs to be a bit more nuanced.
Thank you all very much. We are now encroaching on lunch, so I'll draw things to a close. But as I expected, that was fascinating stuff from all of you. Thank you all very much for some great contributions.